Chapter 4. The hour fixed was 12, but Mushkin was quite unexpectedly late. On his return home, he found the general waiting for him. He saw at the first glance that the old man was displeased, and very likely just because he had been kept waiting. Apologizing, Mushkin made haste to sit down, but he felt strangely timid, as though his guest were made of porcelain and he were afraid of breaking him. He had never felt timid with the general before. It had never entered his head to feel so. Mushkin soon perceived that he was a perfectly different man from what he had been yesterday. Instead of agitation and incoherence, there was an unmistakable, a visible and marked reserve. It could be seen that this was a man who had taken an irrevocable decision. But his composure was more apparent than real. In any case, the visitor displayed a gentlemanly ease of manner, though with reserved dignity. He even treated Mushkin at first with an air of condescension, as proud people who have been gratuitously insulted sometimes do behave with gentlemanly ease. He spoke affably, though with a certain aggrieved intonation.
"Your book, which I borrowed from you the other day,"
he said, nodding significantly at a book he had brought, which was lying on the table.
"I thank you."
"Oh, yes. Have you read that article, General? How did you like it? It's interesting, isn't it?"
Mushkin was delighted at the chance of beginning to talk on an irrelevant subject.
"Interesting, perhaps, but crude, and of course absurd. Probably a lie in every sentence."
The general spoke with aplomb, and even drawled his words a little.
"Oh, it's such an unpretentious story. The story of an old soldier who was an eyewitness of the arrival of the French in Moscow. Some things in it are charming. Besides, every account given by an eyewitness is precious, isn't it? Whoever he may be."
"Had I been the editor, I would not have printed it. As for the descriptions of eyewitnesses in general, people are more ready to believe crude liars who are amusing than a man of worth who has seen service. I know some descriptions of the year 1812 which... I've come to a determination, Prince. I am leaving this house, the house of Mr. Lebediev."
The general looked significantly at Mushkin.
"You have your own rooms at Pavlovsk. At your daughter's," said Mushkin,
not knowing what to say. He remembered that the general had come to ask his advice about a most important matter, on which his fate depended.
"At my wife's. In other words, at home, in my daughter's house."
"I beg your pardon,
I'm leaving Lebediev's house because, dear Prince, because I have broken with that man. I broke with him yesterday evening and regret I did not do so before. I insist on respect, Prince, and I wish to receive it even from those upon whom I bestow, so to speak, my heart. Prince, I often bestow my heart, and I am almost always deceived. That man is not worthy of what I gave him."
"There's a great deal in him that's extravagant," Mushkin observed discreetly, "and some traits... But in the midst of it all, one can perceive a good heart, and a sly and sometimes amusing intelligence."
The nicety of the expressions and the respectfulness of the tone flattered the general, though he still looked at Mushkin sometimes with sudden mistrustfulness. But Mushkin's tone was so natural and sincere that he could not suspect it.
"That he has good qualities," the general assented. "I was the first to declare when I almost bestowed my friendship on that individual. I have no need of his house and his hospitality, having a family of my own. I do not justify my failings. I am weak. I have drunk with him, and now perhaps I am weeping for it. But it was not for the sake of the drink alone. Excuse, Prince, the coarseness of candour in an irritated man. It was not for the sake of the drink alone I became friendly with him. What allured me was just, as you say, his qualities. But all only to a certain point, even his qualities. And if he suddenly has the impudence to declare to one's face that in 1812, when he was a little child, he lost his left leg and buried it in the Vagankovsky Cemetery in Moscow, he is going beyond the limit, showing disrespect and being impertinent.
Perhaps it was only a joke to raise a laugh.
I understand. An innocent lie, however crude, to raise a laugh does not wound a human heart. One man will tell a lie, if you like, simply from friendship, to please the man he is talking to. But if there's a suspicion of disrespect, If he means to show just by such disrespect that he is weary of the friendship, there's nothing left for a man of honour but to turn away, and break off all connection, putting the offender in his proper place."
The general positively flushed as he spoke.
"Why, Lebediev could not have been in Moscow in 1812. He's not old enough. It's absurd." "That's the first thing. But even supposing he could have been born then, how can he declare to one's face that the French chasseur aimed a cannon at him and shot off his leg just for fun? That he picked the leg up and carried it home, and afterwards buried it in the Vagankovsky Cemetery? And he says that he put a monument over it with an inscription on one side, 'Here lies the leg of the collegiate secretary Lebediev,' and on the other, 'Rest, beloved ashes, till the dawn of a happy resurrection,' and that he had a service read over it every year, which is nothing short of blasphemy, and that he goes to Moscow every year for the occasion. To prove it, he invites me to go to Moscow to show me the tomb, and even the very cannon taken from the French now in the Kremlin. He declares it's the 11th from the gate, a French falconet of an old-fashioned pattern."
"And besides, he has both his legs uninjured, apparently," laughed Mushkin. "I assure you it was harmless jest. Don't be angry."
"But allow me to have my own opinion. As for his appearing to have two legs, that's not altogether improbable. He declares that he got his leg from Chernosvitov."
"Oh, yes. They say that people can dance with legs from that maker."
"I'm perfectly aware of that. When Chernosvitov invented his leg, the first thing he did was to run and show it to me. But his legs were invented much later. What's more, he asserts that his late wife never knew, all the years they were married, that her husband had a wooden leg. When I observed to him how foolish it all was, he said to me, 'If you were a page of Napoleon's in 1812, you might let me bury my leg in Vagankovsky.'"
"But did you really—" Mushkin began, and broke off embarrassed. The general, too, seemed a shade embarrassed, but at the same instant he looked at Mushkin with distinct condescension and even irony.
"Go on, Prince, go on," he drawled with peculiar suavity. "I can make allowances. Speak out. Confess that you are amused at the very thought of seeing before you a man in his present degradation and uselessness, and to hear that that man was an eyewitness of great events. Hasn't he gossiped to you already?"
"No, I've heard nothing from Lebediev, if it's Lebediev you're talking about."
"I suppose the contrary. The particular conversation took place between us yesterday apropos of that strange article in the archives. I remarked on its absurdity, and since I had myself been an eyewitness—" "You are smiling, Prince. You are looking at my face." I am youngish-looking," the general drawled the words, "but I am somewhat older in years than I appear. In 1812 I was in my 10th or 11th year. I don't quite know my own age exactly. In my service list my age is less. It has been my weakness all my life to make myself out younger than I am."
"I assure you, General, that I don't think it strange that you should have been in Moscow in 1812. And, of course, you could describe, like everyone else who was there. One of our writers begins his autobiography by saying that when he was a baby in arms in Moscow in 1812, he was fed with bread by the French soldiers."
"There, you see," the general condescendingly approved. "What happened to me was, of course, out of the ordinary, but there is nothing incredible in it. Truth very often seems impossible. Page. It sounds strange, of course, but the adventure of a 10-year-old boy may perhaps be explained just by his age. It wouldn't have happened to a boy of 15, that's certain. For at 15 I should not, on the day of Napoleon's entry into Moscow, have run out of the wooden house in old Bassman Street, where I was living with my mother, who had not left the town in time and was terror-stricken. At 15 I too should have been afraid, but at 10 I feared nothing. And I forced my way through the crowd to the very steps of the palace just when Napoleon was dismounting from the horse."
"Certainly that's a very true remark, that at 10 years old one might not be afraid," Mushkin assented, abashed and distressed by feeling that he was just going to blush.
"Most certainly. And it all happened as simply and naturally as possible in reality. Set a novelist to work on the subject, he would weave in all sorts of incredible and improbable details."
"Oh, that's true," cried Mushkin. "I was struck by the same idea quite lately. I know a genuine case of murder for the sake of stealing a watch. It's appearing in the newspapers now. If some author had invented it, critics and those who know the life of the people would have cried out at once that it was improbable. But reading it in the newspapers as a fact, you feel that in such facts you are studying the reality of Russian life. That's an excellent observation of yours, General, Mushkin concluded warmly, greatly relieved at finding a refuge from his blushes.
Isn't it? Isn't it? Cried the General, his eyes sparkling with pleasure. A boy, a child who knows nothing of fear, makes his way through the crowd to see the fine show, the uniforms, the suite, and the great man about whom he has heard such a lot. For at that time people had talked of nothing else for years. The world was full of that name. I drank it in with my milk, so to speak. Napoleon was 2 paces away when he chanced to catch my eye. I looked like a little nobleman. They dressed me well. There was no one like me in the crowd, you may believe.
No doubt it must have struck him and have shown him that everyone had not left Moscow, and that there were still some of the nobility there with their children.
Just so, just so. He wanted to win over the boyars. When he bent his eagle glance upon me, my eye must have flashed in response. Vous êtes un garçon bien élevé. Qui est son père? I answered him at once, almost breathless with excitement. A general who died in the field for his country. Le fils d'un boyard et d'un brave pas de sous la marche. Jamais le boyard, même tout petit. To this rapid question, I answered as rapidly. A Russian heart can discern a great man even in the enemy of his country. That is, I don't remember whether I literally used those words. I was a child. But that was certainly the drift of them. Napoleon was struck. He thought a moment and said to his suite, I like the pride of that child. But if all Russians think like that child, then... He said no more, but walked into the palace. I at once mingled with the suite and ran after him. They made way for me, and already looked upon me as a favourite. But all that was only for a moment. I only remember that when the Emperor went into the first room, he stopped before the portrait of the Empress Catherine, looked at it a long time thoughtfully, and at last pronounced, "That was a great woman," and passed by. Within 2 days, everyone knew me in the palace and the Kremlin and called me Le Petit Boyard. I only went home to sleep. At home, they were almost frantic about it. 2 days later, one of Napoleon's pages, Baron de Bassancourt, died, exhausted by the campaign. Napoleon remembered me. They took me, brought me to him without explanation. They tried on me the uniform of the dead page, a boy of 12, and when they had brought me, wearing the uniform, to the Emperor, and he had nodded to me, they announced to me that I had been found worthy of favour, and appointed a page-in-waiting to His Majesty. I was glad. I had, in fact, long felt warmly attracted by him, and besides, as you know very well, a brilliant uniform means a great deal to a child. I wore a dark green dress coat, with long narrow tails, gold buttons, red edgings worked with gold on the sleeves, and with a high, erect, open collar worked in gold, and embroidery on the tails. Tight white chamois leather breeches, a white silk waistcoat, silk stockings and buckled shoes. And when the Emperor rode out, if I was one of the suite, I wore high-top boots. Although the situation was anything but promising, and there was a feeling of terrible catastrophe in the air, etiquette was kept up as far as possible, and in fact, the greater the foreboding of catastrophe, the more rigorous was the court punctilio.
Yes, of course, muttered Mushkin, with an almost hopeless air. Your memoirs would be extremely interesting. The general, of course, had been repeating the story he had already told Lebedev the day before, and so he repeated it fluently. But at this point he stole a mistrustful glance at Mushkin again.
My memoirs, he brought out with redoubled dignity. Write my memoirs? That is not a temptation to me, Prince. If you will have it, my memoirs are already written, but they are lying in my desk. When my eyes are closed for ever in the grave, then they may be published, and no doubt they will be translated into foreign languages, not for the sake of their literary value, no, but from the importance of the tremendous events of which I have been the eyewitness, though as a child, the more for that indeed. As a child, I had the entry into the private bedroom, so to speak, of the great man. I heard at night the groans of that titan in agony. He could not feel ashamed to groan and weep before a child, though I understood even then that the cause of his distress was the silence of the Emperor Alexander.
Well, to be sure, he wrote letters with overtures of peace, Mushkin assented timidly.
We don't know precisely with what overtures he wrote, but he wrote every day, every hour, letter after letter. He was fearfully agitated. One night, when we were alone, I flew to him weeping. Oh, I loved him. Beg, beg forgiveness of the Emperor Alexander, I cried to him. Of course, I ought to have used the expression, make peace with the Emperor Alexander, but like a child I naively expressed all I felt. Oh, my child, he replied. He paced up and down the room. Oh, my child. He did not seem to notice at that time that I was only 10 and liked to talk to me. Oh, my child, I am ready to kiss the feet of the Emperor Alexander, but then the King of Prussia, and then the Austrian Emperor. Oh, for them my hatred is everlasting, and at last, of course, you know nothing of politics. He seemed to suddenly to remember to whom he was speaking and ceased, but there were gleams of fire in his eyes long after. Well, say I describe all these facts, and I was the eyewitness of the greatest events. Say I publish my memoirs now, and all the critics, the literary vanities, all the cliques. Oh, no, your humble servant.
Well, as for cliques, no doubt your observation is a true one, and I agree with you, Mushkin observed quietly after a moment's silence. I read not long ago a book by Sharas about the Waterloo campaign. It is evidently a genuine book, and experts say that it is written with great knowledge. But on every page one detects glee at the humiliation of Napoleon, and if it had been possible to dispute Napoleon's genius in every other campaign, Sharas would be extremely glad to do it. And that's not right in such a serious work, because it's the spirit of partisanship. Had you much to do in waiting on the Emperor? The general was delighted. The earnestness and simplicity of Mushkin's question dissipated the last traces of his mistrustfulness.
Sharas! Oh, I was indignant myself. I wrote to him myself at the time, but I don't remember now. You ask me if I had much to do in Napoleon's service. Oh, no, I was called a page in waiting, but even at the time I did not take it seriously. Besides, Napoleon soon lost all hope of winning over the Russians, and no doubt he would have forgotten me, whom he had adopted from policy, if he had not taken a personal fancy to me. I say that boldly now. My heart was drawn to him. My duties were not exacting. I had sometimes to be present in the palace and to attend the Emperor when he rode out, that was all. I rode a horse fairly well. He used to drive out before dinner. Davoust, I, and Mameluke, Roustan, were generally in his suite.
Constant. The name was pronounced almost involuntarily by Mushkin.
No. Constant was not there then. He had gone with a letter to the Empress Josephine. His place was taken by two orderlies and some Polish Uhlans, and that made up the whole suite, except for the generals and marshals, whom Napoleon took with him to explore the neighbourhood and consult about the position of the troops. The one who was oftenest in attendance was Davoust, as I remember now, a huge, stout, cold-blooded man in spectacles, with a strange look in his eyes. He was consulted more often than anyone by the Emperor, who appreciated his judgment. I remember they were in consultation for several days. Davoust used to go in to him morning and evening. Often they even argued. At last Napoleon seemed to be brought to agree. They were alone in the Emperor's study. I was present, scarcely observed by them. Suddenly Napoleon's eye chanced to fall upon me. A strange thought gleamed in his eye. "A child," said he to me, "what do you think? If I adopt the Orthodox faith and set free your slaves, will the Russians come over to me or not?" "Never," I cried indignantly. Napoleon was impressed. "In the patriotism shining in that child's eyes," said he, "I read the verdict of the whole Russian people. Enough, Davoust. That's all a fantasy. Explain your other plan."
"But there was a great idea in that plan, too," said Mushkin, evidently growing interested. "So you would ascribe that project to Davoust?"
"At any rate, they consulted together. No doubt the idea was Napoleon's, the idea of an eagle, but there was an idea, too, in the other plan. That was the famous Conseil de Lyon, as Napoleon himself called that advice of Davoust's. That advice was to shut himself up in the Kremlin with all the troops, to build barracks, to dig out earthworks, to place cannons, to kill as many horses as possible and salt the flesh, to procure by purchase or pillage as much corn as possible, and to spend the winter there till spring, and in the spring to fight their way through the Russians. This plan fascinated Napoleon. We used to ride round the Kremlin walls every day. He used to show where to demolish, where to construct lunettes, ravelins, or a row of blockhouses. He had a quick eye, swift judgment, a sure aim. Everything was settled at last. Davoust insisted on a final decision. Once more they were alone, except for me. Again Napoleon paced the room with folded arms. I could not take my eyes off his face. My heart throbbed. "I am going," said Davoust. "Where?" asked Napoleon. "To salt horse flesh," said Davoust. Napoleon shuddered. It was the turning point. "Child," said he to me suddenly, "what do you think of our intention?" No doubt he asked me, as sometimes a man of the greatest intelligence will at the last moment toss up to decide. I turned to Davoust instead of Napoleon and spoke as though by inspiration. "You'd better cut and run home, General." The plan was abandoned. Davoust shrugged his shoulders and went out, muttering in a whisper, "Bah! Il devient superstitieux." And the next day the retreat was ordered.
"All that is extremely interesting," Mushkin murmured in a very low voice. "If it really was so, I mean to say..." He hastened to correct himself.
"Oh, Prince!" cried the General,
so carried away by his own story that perhaps he could not stop short, even of the most flagrant indiscretion.
"You say, if it really was so, but there was more, I assure you, far more. These are only paltry political facts, but I repeat, I was the witness of the tears and groans of that great man at night, and that no one saw but I. Towards the end, indeed, he ceased to weep. There were no more tears. He only moaned at times, but his face was more and more overcast, as it were with darkness, as though eternity had already cast its dark wings about it. Sometimes at night we spent whole hours alone together, in silence. The Mameluk Roustan would be snoring in the next room, and the fellow slept fearfully soundly. 'But he is devoted to me and to my dynasty,' Napoleon used to say about him. Once I was dreadfully grieved, and suddenly he noticed tears in my eyes. He looked at me tenderly. 'You feel for me,' he cried. 'You, a child, and perhaps another boy will feel for me. My son, le roi de Rome. All the rest, all hate me, and my brothers will be the first to betray me in misfortune.' I began to sob and flew to him. But then he broke down. He threw his arms round me, and our tears flowed together. 'Do, do write a letter to the Empress Josephine,' I sobbed to him. Napoleon started, pondered, and said to me, 'You remind me of the one other heart that loves me. I thank you, my dear.' He sat down on the spot and wrote the letter to the Empress Josephine, which was taken by Constant next day.
'You did splendidly,' said Mushkin. 'In the midst of his evil thoughts, you led him to good feelings.'
"Just so, Prince, and how well you put it! How like your own good heart!"
cried the General rapturously, and, strange to say, genuine tears stood in his eyes.
"Yes, Prince, yes. That was a magnificent spectacle. But do you know, I very nearly went back with him to Paris, and should no doubt have shared with him his sultry prison isle. But alas, fate severed us. We were parted, he to the sultry prison isle, where, who knows, he may have recalled in hours of tragic tribulation the tears of the poor boy who embraced him and forgave him Moscow. I was sent to the cadet corps, where I found nothing but strict discipline, the roughness of comrades, and, alas, all turned to dust and ashes. "I don't want to part you from your mother and take you with me," he said to me on the day of the retreat, "but I should like to do something for you." He had already mounted his horse. "Write something as a souvenir for me in my sister's album," said I timidly, for he was very troubled and gloomy. He turned, asked for a pen, took the album. "How old is your sister?" he asked me. 3 years old," I answered. "Une petite fille, alors." And he wrote in the album, "Vous montez jamais. Napoleon, votre ami sincère." Such advice, and in such a moment, Prince, you can imagine.
Yes, that was remarkable.
And that page was framed in gold under glass and always used to hang on the wall in my sister's drawing-room. In the most conspicuous place, it hung there till her death. She died in childbirth. Where it is now, I don't know, but, oh, heaven, it's 2 o'clock already. How I have kept you, Prince, it's unpardonable.
The general got up from his chair. "Oh, on the contrary," mumbled Mushkin. "You have so entertained me, and in fact it's so interesting. I'm so grateful to you."
"Prince," said the general again, squeezing his hand till it hurt,
gazing at him with sparkling eyes as though suddenly thunderstruck at some thought he had recollected.
"Prince, you are so kind, so good-hearted, that I am sometimes positively sorry for you. I'm touched when I look at you. Oh, God bless you! May a new life begin for you, blossoming with love. Mine is over. Oh, forgive me, goodbye."
He went out quickly, covering his face with his hands. Mushkin could not doubt the genuineness of his emotion. He realized, too, that the old man had gone away enraptured at his success. Yet he had a misgiving that he was one of that class of liars with whom lying has become a blinding passion, though at the very acme of their intoxication they secretly suspect that they are not believed, and that they cannot be believed. In his present position, the old man might be overwhelmed with shame when he returned to the reality of things. He might suspect Mushkin of too great a compassion for him and feel insulted. "Haven't I made it worse by leading him on to such flights?" Mushkin wondered uneasily, and suddenly he could not restrain himself, and laughed violently for 10 minutes. He was nearly beginning to reproach himself for his laughter, but at once realized that he had nothing to reproach himself with, since he had an infinite pity for the general. His misgiving proved true. In the evening he received a strange letter, brief but resolute. The general informed him that he was parting from him, too, forever, that he respected him and was grateful to him, but that even from him he could not accept
proofs of compassion which were derogatory to the dignity of a man who was unhappy enough without that.
When Mushkin heard that the old man had taken refuge with Nina Alexandrovna, he felt almost at ease about him. But we have seen already that the general had caused some sort of trouble at Lizaveta Prokofievna's, too. Here we cannot go into the details, but we will mention briefly that the upshot of the interview was that the general scared Lizaveta Prokofievna, and by his bitter insinuations against Ganya had roused her to indignation. He was led out in disgrace. That was why he had spent such a night and such a morning, was completely unhinged, and had run out into the street almost in a state of frenzy. Kolya had not yet fully grasped the position, and even hoped to bring him round by severity.
"Well, where are we off to now, do you suppose, General?" he said. "You don't want to go to the prince's. You've quarrelled with Lebediev. You've no money, and I never have any. We're in a nice mess in the street."
"It's better to be of a mess than in a mess. I made that pun to the admiration of the officers' mess in 44. In 1844, yes. I don't remember. Oh, don't remind me, don't remind me. Where is my youth? Where is my freshness?" As exclaimed... Who exclaimed it, Kolya?
"Gogol, father, in Dead Souls," answered Kolya, and he stole a timid glance at his father.
"Dead Souls! Oh, yes, dead... When you bury me, write on the tombstone, 'Here lies a dead soul. Disgrace pursues me.' Who said that, Kolya?"
"I don't know, father.
There was no such person as Eropyugov. Eroshka, Eropyugov, he cried frantically, stopping short in the street. And that was said by my son, my own son. Eropyugov, who for 11 months took the place to me of a brother, for whom I fought a duel. Prince Fugorietsky, our captain, said to him over a bottle, Grisha, where did you get your Anna ribbon? Tell me that. On the battlefield of my country, that's where I got it, I shouted. Bravo, Grisha! And that led to a duel, and afterwards he was married to Maria Petrovna, Satugin, and was killed in the field. A bullet glanced off the cross of my breast and hit him straight in the brow. I shall never forget, he cried, and fell on the spot. I've served with honour, Kolya. I've served nobly, but disgrace pursues me. You and Nina will come to my grave. Poor Nina, I used to call her so in old days, Kolya, long ago in our early days, and how she loved. Nina, Nina, what have I made of your life? For what can you love me, long-suffering soul? Your mother has the soul of an angel, Kolya. Do you hear? Of an angel.
I know that, Father. Father Dunning, let's go back home to Mother. She was running after us. Come, why are you standing still, as though you don't understand? Why are you crying? Kolya shed tears himself and kissed his father's hands.
You're kissing my hands. Mine.
Yes, yours, yours. What is there to wonder at? Come, why are you crying in the middle of the street? And you call yourself a general, an army man? Come, let's go.
May God bless you, dear boy, for having been respectful to a wretched, disgraceful old man. Yes, to a wretched, disgraceful old man, your father. May you too have such a boy. Le roi de Rome. Oh, a curse! A curse on this house!
But why on earth are you going on like this? Cried Kolya, boiling over suddenly. What has happened? Why won't you go home now? Why have you gone out of your mind?
I'll explain. I'll explain to you. I'll tell you everything. Don't shout. People will hear. Le roi de Rome. Oh, I'm sick. I'm sad. Nurse, where is thy tomb? Who was it cried that, Kolya?
I don't know. I don't know who cried it. Let's go home at once, at once. I'll give Ganya a hiding if necessary. But where are you off to again?
But the general drew him to the steps of a house close by.
Where are you going? That's a stranger's house.
The general sat down on the step, still holding Kolya's hand and drawing him to him.
Bend down, he muttered. I'll tell you everything. Disgrace. Bend down, your ear, your ear. I'll tell you in your ear.
But what is it?
Cried Kolya, terribly alarmed, yet stooping down to listen.
Le roi de Rome, whispered the general.
He too seemed trembling all over.
What? Why do you keep harping on Le roi de Rome? What?
I...
whispered the general again, clinging more and more tightly to his boy's shoulder.
I want to... I'll tell you everything. Maria... Maria Petrovna...
Kolya tore himself away, seized the general by the shoulders, and looked at him frantically. The old man flushed crimson. His lips turned blue. Faint spasms ran over his face. Suddenly, he lurched forward and began slowly sinking into Kolya's arms.
"A stroke!"
the boy shouted aloud in the street, seeing at last what was the matter.